right foot moving, left foot moving, right foot moving. So you're keeping your attention in a very small area of reality, just the movement of the feet. To go to the equivalent of the beautiful breath, as you watch the movement of the feet more and more, you'll find that the samadhi, the sustained attention, will grow, and you'll find more to watch as the foot moves. To develop this to the point where you know the very first part of your foot which moves off from the ground, whether it's the ball of the foot, the toes, or the heel, the side of the foot, how does your foot move? And see what happens when it moves up off the ground. Does it go backwards first or forward straight away? Just notice all the sensations which tell you how your foot moves. To the point where the foot touches the ground. And again, which point touches the ground first of all? What does it feel like to be touching the ground again? And just see how the whole foot slowly, piece by piece, meets the ground and takes the weight of the body so you can start the next movement of the leg or the foot. To notice all the movements involved in just one step at a time. As you notice this, as your mindfulness increases and you get to know more and more of the sensations of walking, then you find the walking does have this beautiful sense of beauty and peace to it. It becomes a beautiful step. And it can very easily absorb all of your attention, which you become fascinated and peaceful, just putting all your attention just on walking. And you can get a great deal of samadhi through walking meditation in this way. That samadhi is a sense of peacefulness, a sense of stillness, a sense of the mind just being a very comfortable and very peaceful corner of the world. When I started doing my walking meditation, when I first ordained as a monk in the temple in Thailand, I would choose a path and quite naturally, without forcing it, I'd walk very, very slowly. You don't need to walk fast, you don't need to walk slowly, just do what feels comfortable. I used to get into such beautiful samadhi states during walking meditation that I recall once of being disturbed because I'd been walking too long, I hadn't noticed the time pass, and I was needed to go to a ceremony in this temple in Bangkok, and one of the monks had been sent to go and get me. And I recall this monk coming up to me and saying, "Brahma Wangsa, you've got to come to a dana." And my head was just looking at a space about 2 meters in front. My arms were in front of me, my hands folded. And when I heard that, it was as if hearing it from 1,000 miles away. So I was so absorbed into what I was doing. I said, "Brahma Wangsa, you have to come now." And it took me about 1 minute to lift my head from the ground and to turn it around to the side where this senior monk was trying to get my attention. And as I met his eyes, all I could say was, "Pardon?" It took such a long time to get out of that samadhi and actually do anything quickly, because the mind was just so cool and so peaceful and so still. So walking meditation is very beautiful, especially beautiful in the early morning. If ever you read any of the suttas, these are the teachings in the Buddhist canon, you'll usually find that the Buddha would walk meditation in the early morning. He wouldn't be sitting, he'd be walking very often in the early morning. And that's a very beautiful time to do walking meditation. Very often that when you get up first thing in the morning, especially at 4 o'clock when you're not used to getting up so early, you're quite tired and the mind isn't bright. One of the advantages of walking meditation is you can't nod while you're walking meditation. You don't snore while you're walking. You're awake if you have to be. And that way, that if you are tired, walking meditation is very, very good to do. It brings up some energy and you can still get very peaceful. But be careful when you're walking meditation. Don't go thinking too much. Don't go philosophizing. Don't go working it all out. Because that's what happens very often when people do walking meditation. Really, it's not walking meditation, it's thinking meditation. They're talking to themselves all the time. Do it quietly, do it carefully, and you'll find it becomes very enjoyable. And you can do as much walking as you wish. There are some monks, I know in Thailand, whose main practice is walking meditation. They do very little sitting meditation. They do a lot of walking. Many get tremendously powerful insights while they're walking meditation. So please don't look upon it as a second-class meditation. If you want to spend most of the time while you're here doing walking meditation, please do so. But do it well, do it carefully, and see if you can develop that happiness of serenity as you're just walking backwards and forwards, not looking at the sky, 2 meters in front of you, arms in front, just experiencing the feeling of the feet on the green, cold grass. So that's just a little bit on walking meditation. Now I wanted to especially devote this period to talking about the five hindrances. And this is an important part of meditation practice because any obstacle to deep meditation will take the form of one or more of these five hindrances. So if you haven't got into jhana yet, it means there's hindrances at play there. And so it's important to know the obstacles so that we know what we're facing, we can recognize them, overcome them, and get deeper into meditation. In brief, those five hindrances are like concern for the five senses, which includes the body. It's ill will is the second. The third is sloth and torpor. The fourth is restlessness and remorse. The fifth is doubt. The first one, which is concern for the five senses, is one of the most deep and difficult to overcome. It manifests as any concern for your body, whether it's a concern for an itch on your face, or a mosquito on your arm, a pain in your leg, or whatever. Even the sounds outside. Sometimes there's a sound outside. We wonder why that sound disturbs us. The sound disturbs us because the mind goes out to that sound, listens to it, to try and find out whether it's anything we should really be, which is a danger to us. We can't leave that sound alone. The same way we can't leave the itch alone. We can't leave the feeling saliva in our throat alone. We are overly concerned with this body and its five senses. Those realm of the five senses includes everything from the search for pleasure and satisfaction with the body to just comfort in this body. When you're sitting meditation, it's hard to be able to sit still without any discomfort. It doesn't matter whether you're old or young, whether you're sick or healthy. All people have some degree of discomfort with this body. Whether it's a bad stomach, whether it's a headache, whether it's some itch or ache or disease or whatever. There's always something wrong with this body. And you can see that every time you move, whether it's even to blink an eyelid, is because of discomfort in the body, trying to find some release from the irritation, trying to find some comfort. It is the illusion of human beings to think they can find some peace, some comfort, some happiness in this body by following the desires of the sensory world. I know that if I scratch an itch, another one will come up afterwards. But if I move one leg because it's aching, then another leg will ache. You ever notice that? You think, well, if I just scratch this one itch, then I'll be okay, then I can still be peaceful for the rest of the meditation. You scratch one itch and another one comes up almost immediately afterwards. That's the body. The only way to overcome that sensory desire, that concern for the five senses, is to leave them completely alone, to be able to sit in a reasonably comfortable posture, but don't expect it to be perfect. And when you sat in a reasonably comfortable position, if any ache or pain, itch or whatever comes up, just leave it alone. Don't pay attention to it. Instead, take the attention away from the world of the five senses and put it on the meditation object. It's not hard to overcome the world of the five senses if you know how. You do this quite often when you're listening to a favorite piece of music, or you're watching the TV, or you're absorbed in a book. When you're absorbed in something because you're enjoying it, the rest of the five sense world disappears. How many people have been reading a book, and after they finish the last chapter, only then does a headache come back, or does the stomach ache come, or they realize that their legs are in a very difficult position and it's gone to sleep. Even like disturbing sounds. A couple of years ago, some disciples, I'm embarrassed to say this, they told me that one evening they were watching the television in their home, and when the television show had finished, they turned around and saw a lot of their possessions had disappeared. A thief had broken in while they were watching the television, and in the same room had taken them from that room and got out again. And the owners hadn't even noticed that the thieves had come in. They'd been so absorbed in the television program, they hadn't heard any sounds at all. I'm sure that you can relate to such a scenario. Maybe your house hasn't been burgled, but there have been many times, I'm sure, that burglars could have come into your house and taken whatever they wanted because you've been so absorbed in your television program. But here, just somebody coughs, or the door is slammed, and straight away we hear it and it disturbs our meditation. It shows we're not really absorbed enough in our object of meditation. All of these things, the disturbance caused by the five senses, is called the first hindrance. We have to overcome that in order to release the mind. So you sit down and you make a resolution that once you're comfortable, I'm not going to move this body anymore. I'm not be concerned about the world outside of the world of this body. I spend too much time on this body and the five senses anyway. Now I'm going to put all the attention on this part of meditation. Present moment awareness, one point, silence, just focusing just on one thing, on the breath. And focusing to the point that even the breath disappears. And so all the five senses completely shut down to reveal the mind. That's the first hindrance. Every time in your meditation there's a distraction caused by a feeling in the body, by a sound outside, know that as first hindrance. Concern for the five external senses: sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. The second hindrance is ill will. That ill will is not just to another person, because usually people who come to a meditation retreat like this aren't going around hating people. They're very good people. A very high standard of people come to a meditation retreat. I doubt very much whether you have feelings of ill will or anger to any person outside of here or any person inside here. Although sometimes you can have ill will towards a teacher. especially if I talk too long. One of the retreats I gave some time ago, that I would be a bit more strict with the times for sittings. When it was like a sit from 9 to 10, I expected people to be there, and at 10 o'clock I'd ring the bell and say, okay, walking meditation now. And then half an hour later I'd ring the bell, come on, now sitting meditation again. And this one lady she was waiting for the bell, she hardly ever got any good meditation. And she always got so angry at me, said, why isn't he ringing the bell now? I'm sure he's going to an extra 5 minutes or 10 minutes. Doesn't he know I'm hurting? And so she got angry with me many, many days because I didn't ring the bell early enough. And then the very last day, she said, she got angry with me again. Because for once, she had a really good meditation. And then after an hour, I rang the bell and she didn't want to finish. And she was angry with me once more. So you can't win as a teacher. But that ill will is more often, more likely, to be towards oneself or towards the meditation object. The ill will towards oneself is something which you should really watch out for and really investigate to see whether that's a hindrance which is stopping you getting deep in meditation. This was actually pointed out to me quite a few years ago when one of the Western nuns, not the nun in Gitigana, not Sister Wayama, but another one, was telling me about her meditation, and very often she got very deep in meditation, almost but not quite into jhanas. She was at the door, she said, and the thing which stopped her was feeling that she didn't deserve this happiness. It was ill will towards herself, the inability to grant herself the bliss. She thought she did not deserve it. And I've seen that in many people since. Sometimes that when the meditation gets peaceful, when happiness comes up, sometimes we think there must be something wrong here. You have ill will towards yourself, so you don't permit yourself to be happy, to be free. Please know that you have the permission of the Buddha and all the Arahants to get into jhana and to be free. This is your right. This is your privilege. Please take it. And if you find that at any time in the meditation there is a blockage there, ask yourself, are you allowing yourself to be peaceful? Are you allowing yourself to be happy? Or are you blocking the progress of meditation through ill will towards yourself? Very often you will find that you are blocking, at which occasion you should overcome that hindrance by loving kindness metta towards yourself. And to say, may I be happy and well, may I forgive all my faults, any wrong, bad things which I've done, I forgive, I can let them go. There's no point to punishing myself by stopping myself enjoying the happiness and peace of meditation. Allow yourself to enjoy that happiness. Sometimes that happiness in meditation might be so strong and powerful, you might also feel fear. Please have that confidence and faith, you know, in what I say, and what you read in the suttas, what the Buddha said, that happiness and power of deep meditation, the bliss of jhana, should not be feared. There is no bad side effects to this. You won't go crazy. Nothing bad will happen to you. The worst which can happen to you is you come up afterwards and come and join the monastery, give up your job, give up your husband or wife, and come and become a monk or a nun. That's probably the worst which can happen to you, but that's really the best in my book. But as far as health of body and mind is concerned, that bliss of meditation is nothing to fear. And the Buddha said that again and again and again in the suttas. The bliss of jhana, as he said, nabhayitabhang, is not to be feared, but is to be made much of, to be indulged in, because it leads to only good things. So if you do come across a barrier to deeper happiness, check out to see whether it's ill will towards yourself, and give yourself loving kindness. Give yourself permission to be free, to enjoy happiness. Forgive any faults, and that way you will allow yourself the happiness of deep meditation. Sometimes it can be ill will towards the meditation object itself. And again, this was brought home to me by one monk who stayed here some time ago. You've been practicing breath meditation for quite a few years. You never got very detailed and good instructions when he started. So not really knowing how he should do breath meditation, every time the monks sat together, he would sort of try and watch his breath, but never get anywhere. And after over many years of frustration, of not really getting any happiness and peace in his meditation, because of not clear instructions to start off with, he developed an aversion towards the breath. He knew he had to watch the breath because that's what monks are supposed to do. But he watched it as if it was, here we go again. I just have to do this, but I don't really want to do it. Just breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out. Ah, how long do I have to do this for? Breathing in, breathing out. He had an aversion towards it. The only way that he could hold the breath because of a natural aversion was just by being so tight, so tense. And of course, that made the experience even more unhappy, more suffering. And soon he would just he'd have to give up. He'd just go thinking or fantasizing. Or if he was lucky, he'd just go to sleep. And it's all because he had aversion towards the breath, which had built up over many years. If you have aversion towards a meditation object, then you find that you'll never be able to find samadhi, sustained attention. You never get any peace there. So, if that's your obstacle, develop loving kindness towards a meditation object. This is what I was alluding to earlier, by developing happiness with what you're doing. Loving kindness with what you're doing. For example, if you're watching the breath, to be able to look at the breath with loving kindness. Using your perception, using the way that you regard this meditation object, in a way which, the same way which you'd look upon a baby, your child, or your grandchild. Imagine you were carrying a baby in your arms. Would you drop it because you were thinking of something else? That's what you do with the breath. You drop the breath and you lose it because something is more important. It means you're not caring of the breath. If you go to the shopping mall, would you leave the baby somewhere in the mall because you get distracted by another sound or a friend? If it was your baby, your child, your grandchild, because you value it, because you love it, you would never lose it. That loving kindness towards the breath helps you sustain your attention on it. Loving kindness always engenders happiness and joy. You know, you like holding that baby because you love it, you enjoy its company. In the same way, if you can have loving kindness towards the breath, you can actually enjoy its company. You can care for it and be caring. And that way you'll find the breath does not disappear. You can have loving kindness towards silence. You can have loving kindness towards the present moment. It's just you care for these mental things. And that way you overcome the aversion towards the meditation object. And if you have loving kindness instead towards a meditation object, you do not need much effort to hold a meditation object. You just love it so much, it becomes effortless to be with something which you really value and care for. So be careful of those three aspects of the second hindrance of ill will. It can be ill will to somebody else, but that's unlikely. More likely to be ill will towards oneself, or ill will towards a meditation object. And they're all overcome by the practice of loving kindness. The third hindrance, I saw a lot of this morning, is Tina Mida, sloth and torpor. The one way of overcoming that, sloth and torpor, I don't really need to describe it very much because I think you all know that through your own experience, is when you're sitting here and you don't know really what you're watching, whether it's present moment, silence, or the breath, or whatever, because the mind is dull. It's like there's no lights turned up in the mind. It's just all grey and blurry. One way of overcoming that is to use the Zen practice of the teacher walking around with a big stick. That's certainly where, when I did a meditation retreat once in the north of England. And I remember it was a Sunday morning, very, very early. It was really cold as well, so people had their blankets on. And when you have blankets anywhere close to you, you tend to get sleepy. So, and this teacher was walking up and down, and it was the fellow next to me. He started nodding first, thank goodness. I was very lucky. I was always born with good karma. And so he got hit first of all. And as soon as he was hit, everyone in the room, we talked about it afterwards, everyone in the room, all their sloth and torpor disappeared straight away. You only had one person to volunteer, and that was good enough. It was like fear, wasn't it? Fear was enough to really wake you up. So one good way of overcoming sloth and torpor is like to get some wholesome fear up. Try that mantra, I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. Another way is don't make yourself so comfortable. Take the blankets off. Experience a bit of cold. And that will make you waken up a bit. Or just do some walking meditation. Go outside. People don't like doing walking meditation in the early morning because it's cold. So just don't mind about the cold. After a while it becomes very bracing and invigorating. It overcomes the sloth and torpor. But the main way to overcome sloth and torpor, the most deepest, profound way, is to always realize when you first come into this room, even in the early morning, you're awake. If you start watching the first breath you watch is very clear. Only sometimes after 5-10 minutes you lose it somewhere. And you're into sloth and torpor. Sloth and torpor just creeps up on you. I call it like a python. It creeps up on you and you don't notice it, and it gets its coils around you and it starts to strangle you. It strangles your awareness, your awakeness, your alertness. And so I like to use the simile of the snake here. In Thailand, where I lived for many years, sometimes we'd go walking through the forest barefoot because we didn't have any sandals. Sometimes we didn't even have a flashlight because there was no batteries. And in that forest there were many, many snakes. And they were all poisonous. All except one. You just say there were 100 species of snake. 99 were poisonous. And the other one strangled you to death. They're all dangerous. And so what did I do to avoid being strangled to death or to avoid being bitten? Because I knew they were around the forest, because I knew they were dangerous, even at night time, I walked very carefully. I was always on the lookout for snakes when I walked back from the hall to my hut. Because I was always looking out for them, I'd always see them in plenty of time to avoid them. So I never got bitten. Sloth and torpor is very similar. If you know that sloth and torpor is somewhere around out there, and you're wary of it, you're looking out for it, you can see it before it comes and avoid it. Take a different direction, step over it, you don't get caught. Someone once said that sloth and torpor is like coming through a fork in the road of meditation. And if you have enough carefulness, you know that one fork will lead to sloth and torpor, and the other one will lead to peacefulness, but alertness, awakeness. See if you can notice that fork in the road of meditation. And in your practice, know where that fork is, and know how many times you've taken that road which leads into dullness. And this time, don't take that road. Take the other road which leads to peacefulness and alertness. And that overcomes the sloth and torpor. That road which leads to alertness is this, that when you start to feel yourself getting dull, try doing some counting, try doing a mantra, just energize the mind a little bit. Like the counting method I mentioned yesterday. Breathing in one, breathing out one, breathing in two, breathing out two, in three, out three, in four, out four, up to nine, and one to eight, one to seven, one to six, one to five, one to four. 1 to 3, 1 to 2, and then 1. If you can't do that, it shows that you are sleeping. Get up, do some walking meditation. Go and have a cold shower. Do something just to really get the energies coming up in the body again. That counting I found very useful because it really showed me whether I was sleepy or not. Because sometimes you'll be peaceful. Just peaceful and you think, oh, this is jhana. That's not jhana at all. You just try doing that counting. And then you'll find very, very clearly whether you are mindful or not. Especially in the early morning. If you can't do that counting, just one, breathing in one, breathing out one, breathing in, you find you can't carry on with the counting. It means the mind isn't clear enough. Do mantras, do some chanting to yourself, go out walking. Even walk backwards if you want, that will wake you up. Anything, just to really get some energy coming up. And even put forth a little bit of willpower, just to really watch the breath very closely. There are, in our tradition in northeast Thailand, was always, but sometimes to sit in very dangerous places, on the edge of cliffs. Somewhere where you can fall off, because if you're meditating and you can fall off, then you're always very alert and awake. It's just like having that teacher with a big stick behind you. Or sit in the forest where there are tigers. Or do anything which is outside. Think of ghosts. Anything which just really makes you alert and awake. And then you find you're overcome. That's what sloth and torpor. Eventually, once you really get into good meditation and you get happiness and joy coming up, then sloth and torpor hasn't got a hope of making inroads into your mind. It's only out of a bit of boredom, a lack of interest, a lack of valuing what you're doing. That's where the boredom which gives rise to sloth and torpor comes from. This is important stuff which you're doing here. This is a path into enlightenment. Incredible amounts of wisdom going to come up here if you do the meditation properly. So don't mess around. Just value every breath. This meditation is important. Just imagine that just for this 1 hour sit you pay $200 or something which is just incredibly expensive. Would you be able to waste that? That's actually what lawyers charge per hour. $200 an hour they charge. So you're getting this meditation very cheap. But just think that you sort of, you know, this meditation is going to cost you so much. Don't waste a moment of it. Be alert. That way the sloth and torpor won't sort of grow in your mind. And the fourth hindrance is restlessness and remorse. First of all, the remorse is the result of bad things which you've done. Bad sila, bad virtue. If there's any remorse comes up in the meditation, instead of dwelling on it, lingering on it, just give yourself forgiveness. Everybody makes mistakes. Some people have so much remorse they think, no, someone like me can never become enlightened. I always tell the story of Angulimala. Many of you will probably know that story. It's a very famous story in Buddhist literature. This person was a serial killer. He'd already killed 999 people. And cut off their fingers and put them in a necklace around his head. The serial killer, the 1,000th victim, was to be the Buddha, and of course he can't kill the Buddha. Instead, the Buddha killed him, killed his bad ways, killed his defilements, and converted him. He became a Buddhist monk. And even a serial killer, this person who became a Buddhist monk called Angulimala, even he could get jhanas and become fully enlightened. Even serial killers can become fully enlightened saints. So, have you, any of you ever killed anybody? Are there any serial killers in this room? I'm sure that none of you have done anything like that. So it means if they can become enlightened, surely you can. So no matter what bad things you've done in your past, what things you feel remorse about, always remember Angulimala, and then you don't feel so bad about yourself. he's a serial killer, and he could still get enlightened. That means that you can as well. So forgiveness is what overcomes remorse about things which one has done in the past. The restlessness which comes up is always a sign of not finding joy in what you're doing. This is where that you need to play with this thing we call perception. This thing we call perception is really can be conditioned, can be changed. It's within your power to change the way you look at things. You can look at a glass of water and think it's just something very beautiful and wonderful to look at. Or you can think about it as something ordinary and something mundane. It's just what you add to that experience is what we call this perception. In this particular case, you can look upon the breath as being something just ordinary and mundane, nothing very much. Or you can look upon it as something very beautiful and wonderful, something of great value. If you look upon it as great value, then you won't get restless. You won't go around looking for something else. That's what restlessness is. Going around looking for something else. Something else to do. Something else to think about. Somewhere else to go. Anywhere but here and now. That's called restlessness. Restlessness, again, is one of the big hindrances along with sensory desire. That's why it is just so hard to sit still for very long before the mind just goes and wants to take you somewhere else. That's why that I love to begin the retreat with just present moment awareness. Just to overcome that coarse restlessness which says, I want to be somewhere other than right here, right now. No matter what this place is, no matter how comfortable you make it, restlessness will always say it's not good enough. Restlessness is a fault-finding mind, which looks at, you know, your meditation cushion and it's too big, or it's too small, it's too hard, it's too wide. I want another one. Which looks upon the retreat center. It's not good enough. We should have 3 meals a day. We should have room service. Whatever else you wish for. It's always thinking of ways to improve it because it always looks at the faults. If you have a fault-finding mind, you will always be under the control of restlessness. You'll never be content with where you are. So that joy of contentment, which is the opposite of a fault-finding mind, is what stops restlessness. You just develop the perception of contentment with where you are. Now be very careful of this one, because in your meditation sometimes you think, I'm not going deep enough. Just, I've been watching the present moment for so long, I'm not getting anywhere. That thought is the very cause of restlessness. The dissatisfaction with where you are right now. The lack of contentment. The lack of peace. Doesn't matter how your meditation is going in your eyes. Be absolutely content with it. And it will go deeper. If you're discontent with it, then you're just making it worse. So, learn to put contentment. So it's in the present moment. I'm just content to be in the present moment. Forget about jhanas. I'm just going to be content to be here and now, in this moment. And as that contentment deepens, it will actually give rise to jhanas. I'm just going to watch the silence. I'm just be content to be silent, not say anything. If you're really content, why do you need to say anything? Isn't most words inside just complaints? Trying to change things, trying to do something else, and escape from the present moment into the world of thoughts and ideas. It shows a lack of contentment that you think. Discontent causes movement. So a truly content person is still, is quiet. So see if you can deepen that contentment, because it goes completely against restlessness. Even if you have an ache in the body, you don't really feel good. See if you can turn your mind around to looking upon that as something quite nice and beautiful. To see if you can be content with the ache, with the pain in the body. To be able to allow it in rather than pushing it out. That's happened to me a few times in the life of a monk. Sometimes being in quite severe pain, instead of trying to escape from it, which was restlessness, just turn the mind around to completely accept that pain, to be content with it. And I'm just speaking from experience, it's possible to be content with pain. And if you can do that, the worst part of the pain disappears. There's no restlessness anymore. There's no wanting to get rid of it. You're completely still with the feeling. The restlessness which accompanies pain is probably the worst part of the pain. Get rid of that restlessness through contentment, and you can endure anything with no problem. So developing contentment with whatever you have, contentment with the breath, contentment with the present moment, contentment with silence, whatever you are, develop that contentment. And from that contentment, out of the very center of that contentment, you'll find the meditation will develop. And this is overcoming the restlessness. So if ever you see restlessness in your mind, remember that word, contentment. Know that restlessness comes from the fault-finding mind, always looking for things which are wrong. And contentment looks for what is right. Contentment can keep you still. Restlessness will always make you a slave. That was a simile which the Buddha used. So it's like having this tyrant of a master or a mistress, always telling you, go and get this, go and do that, that's not right, clean that up better. Never giving you a moment's rest. It's restlessness. That tyrant is a fault-finding mind. Will always keep you on the move. Never let you be still. Overcome through contentment. And the last of the hindrances is called doubt. And that doubt can be doubt to the teacher, doubt towards the teaching, or doubt towards yourself. Doubt towards the teacher or the teaching. You should have enough confidence by now, by following these teachings. Many of you have been practicing long enough to know that there are some beautiful results from meditation. You've experienced them already. Use those as confidence that this is something very worthwhile doing. Sitting meditation, developing the mind in samadhi, especially developing the mind in jhanas, is something which is tremendously worthwhile. Will give you a lot of happiness, a lot of clarity, a lot of wisdom, a lot of understanding into the teachings of the Buddha. Very often, a teacher is like a coach of a sports team. Their job is to both show you by experience and to encourage you by words to tread that path to succeed. The doubt in yourself, whether you think you can do this or not, that is very often overcome through a teacher who gives you inspiration and encouragement. It's my job to say, yes, you can achieve all of these things. Many people on retreats have achieved these things, so why not you? Giving yourself encouragement, because that self-doubt, I'm hopeless, I can't do this, I'm useless. I'm sure everyone else in this room, everyone except me, has already got jhanas and is probably next to enlightenment, but not me. Look at that person over there, I saw them this morning, they sat absolutely still for 2 or 3 hours. Yeah, what was that? Don't think like that. Just have that confidence that you can achieve whatever you want. In fact, if you have the determination and the confidence, then it's only a matter of time before you succeed. The only people who fail are those who give up. Don't give up, and you're bound to succeed. So be careful of that doubt. That doubt can also be towards what you're experiencing now. What is this? Is this jhana? Is this present moment awareness? Or whatever else it is. All those thoughts of doubt are again hindrances to meditation. While you are meditating, it's not the time to assess all these things. Make the mind as peaceful as you can. Let go as much as you can. Enjoy the happiness as much as you can. And afterwards, towards the end of the meditation, you can review the meditation and say, what was that? That was really interesting. What was happening then? That's when you'll find out whether it's a jhana or not. If that thought comes up, is this jhana? Then it cannot be jhana. Thoughts like that can't come up in those states. It's only afterwards, when you look back upon these states, you look back and say, ah, that was like that. Hey, that was a jhana. That's how you know. Not at the time, because the mind cannot move in those states. So don't doubt the experience. Just shut up and be quiet and just do the meditation. And afterwards you can find out what's going on. So that's the five hindrances. The concern for the five senses and the body. It's the ill will towards other people, to yourself, to the meditation object. It's wrath and torpor. It's restlessness and remorse. And it's doubt. Whatever obstacle there is in your meditation, it has to be one of those five, or a combination of them. So if you get into any difficulty in the meditation, stop and say, which of the hindrances is this? Find out what the cause is, what the disease is. Once you know what the cause is, the disease is, then know, remember what the solution is. If it's sensory desire, just take the attention away from the five senses and put it on to the breath or the mind. Do substitution. It's ill will, loving kindness. Sloth and torpor, remember the simile of the snake. If it's restlessness and worry, contentment. If it's doubt, confidence. Remember the teachings. Remember you can do this. Know the antidote and apply that. And if it really is that hindrance, the antidote will work very, very quickly. And that way, the obstacles which you experience in meditation aren't something which create lifetime barriers. They're things which you can see, recognize, overcome, and get beyond. And that way, your meditation will deepen. And that way, you'll get insight and understanding into what these five hindrances are. And how they're overcome. So that's the five hindrances in brief. Are there any questions about that or comments about it? Any questions about the five hindrances? Yes? That's right. The accurate meaning of the Pali word is restlessness, is udicca, and remorse is very often said to be worry, but that doesn't really fit the real meaning of the word. The worry comes as part of restlessness. So I mean, worry is still is a hindrance, but I put it in terms of restlessness under that category. Worrying about how much time has gone, whether I'm going to get here or not, what's going to happen next, whether I've locked the car, what's happening back home, or whatever. That's all that sort of worry. Indeed, yes. That's right. They give a simile that restlessness is like waves on a body of water. The more restless you are, the water's just going backwards and forwards, sloshing around. Sometimes that's what the mind is like, just sloshing around. It's not still. It's not calm. Yes? Okay, well, genuine tiredness is sloth and torpor as well. Like sloth is like the tiredness of the body, torpor is the tiredness of the mind. So it's tiredness of either one of these. And always know that the tiredness of the mind, which is the most insidious, the hardest one, because even if you're tired in the body, even if you're really worn out, if it's something you really, really want to do, you can do it. You know, there's always energy there somewhere, if we know how to turn it on. That's why even in the middle of the night, if there's a burglar comes in the house, you know, even if you had a very hard day the day before, you're wide awake as soon as you see that burglar. So you know, there's energy there if you really want to use it. Just turning it on. But the difficult one is the sloth of the mind. It's the mind that doesn't want to do anything. It's just not interested. It's bored. It's just like a street kid on Perth. Just not interested in anything. And it's incredibly stubborn. And that's the one you've got to be very careful of. Sometimes the two can go together. If you're not sleeping enough, then very often it's very easy to get the mental tiredness as well. So have enough sleep. When you sleep, learn how to sleep well by meditating, just doing some letting go, letting be meditation. When you're on your pillow, be in the present moment, be silent and let go. And that way when you do sleep, you sleep very deeply. When you wake up in the morning, get up straight away. You find if you sleep too long, sometimes it just gets into the sloth and torpor of the mind. I've noticed that sometimes I've woken up early, got up straight away, and I've been bright as a button all day. And sometimes I thought, maybe another half an hour, I don't have to get up yet. Just that other half an hour is a killer every time. It just makes you really slothful and torpor all day. You're just not putting energy into what you're doing. Or what I've been teaching at the monastery. When the bell goes or your alarm goes, you wake up, just jump up straight away. Zippity-doo-da, what a lovely day. Here we are again. I'm on a meditation retreat. Oh, this is blissful, great. Only 3 o'clock. Great, an extra hour to meditate. Just that positive energy which you put into what you're doing. And that way, the sort of putting energy in the very first thing you do in the morning really helps. It wakens you up. So this is how to overcome sloth and torpor. But to find out whether it's physical tiredness or whether it's mental tiredness, you can just ask yourself, well, have I really been sleeping enough? Is there something wrong with my body? Is there some sort of rhythms of the body I'm going through which makes me sort of tired? And if you can't really identify any physical cause, and just mental. A lot of the time, though, especially in the meditation retreat, because people don't put enough joy into what they're doing, don't value the meditation, don't get enough happiness up, they get bored. Here we go, another hour of meditation. What am I going to do? I know I'm not going to get anywhere. And so you go sleep. You're not really putting energy into what you're doing. Energy is happiness. Happiness is energy. Again, if any of you do get into a very beautiful meditation like a jhana, just, you know, sloth and torpor get banished for long periods of time. Sometimes you don't even want to sleep at night because you're just so blissed out. You've got so much energy coursing through you, mental energy. So that's one way of looking at it. Was that what you were asking? Okay. Any other questions anyone would like to ask? Okay, if there's any more questions, maybe you can write them on a piece of paper, leave them in the basket.